Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And I'm super excited for this conversation where I'm talking with Dr. Michael Ruscio. Dr. Ruscio is a doctor and clinical researcher and best-selling author whose practical ideas on healing chronic illness have made him an influential voice in functional and alternative medicine. His work has been published in peer-reviewed medical journals, and he speaks at integrative medical conferences across the globe. Dr. Ruscio also runs an influential website and podcast at drruscio.com, as well as his clinical practice located in Northern California. Dr. Ruscio, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me today.
Thank you for having me.
I should also say off the top, you've got an excellent book out, Healthy Gut, Healthy You. I imagine this book took a long time to write. And the reason why I say that is it's extremely well written. It's very well referenced. And having read a lot of books over the last 3 or 4 months prepping for this conference, it's actually one of my favorites. So excellent job on that. And I'd love to really start where the book starts, which is just a little bit with your own story. Because what was interesting to me was that you were kind of coming into the medical world professionally, but then found yourself with your own struggles that weren't responding to traditional approaches. So just tell us a bit about that as we open this up.
Yeah, well, you gave me a good lead in, and thank you for the kind words. And yes, the book was about 3 years in the writing. It was not something I wrote lightly or flippantly, and I really wanted to arm people with a highly scientifically tenable account of the gut and how it works, and also a highly personalizable protocol to really give people a simple path through all the confusion, and just to be able to take one step, reevaluate, take another step, reevaluate, and find their way through this fog of conflicting claims that people are confronted with on the internet, so they can come out the other side with a healthier gut and all the litany of symptomatic improvements we can see as a byproduct of that. And I was the first kind of patient that I had. And as you said, I was on par to go more into traditional medicine. And then at about 23 years of age, I went from feeling pretty fantastic my entire life to having the first symptom that was really debilitating was insomnia. And I mean, I would drive to the local gas station at like 4 o'clock in the morning and buy a candy bar because I was waking up unable to fall asleep and having sugar cravings, knowing all that is bad and thinking to myself, what is going on? It's like I'm not in control of my body. I can't sleep at night, but I'm tired during the day. I'm trying to eat healthy food, but I'm having cravings for chocolate at night. Not to mention, eventually I developed brain fog, fatigue, as I already mentioned, some depression. And none of the conventional doctors that I saw were able to figure things out. And I mean that in no disparagement toward conventional doctors. I just think we all have our areas of strengths and weaknesses. And so if I had a more traditional medical disease, that would have been the right place for me. But since I didn't have that type of disorder present, I had an intestinal infection, then I think functional or integrative medicine was a better camp to really find this. I mean, if the infection was bad enough, conventional medicine probably would have found it, but the challenge, and this is a key takeaway, I didn't have any digestive symptoms. No gas, no bloating, no diarrhea. I mean, the big thing you're looking at with an amoebic infection like I had was chronic diarrhea. Nothing digestively was amiss. It was really all these other symptoms, mostly neurological, that I was experiencing, which taught me that you can have a problem in the gut that's not manifesting as symptoms in the gut, but only manifesting as brain fog, as depression, as insomnia, as joint pain, as hives or skin issues, or whatever it may be that's non-digestive. And now we're seeing the more contemporary body of literature support that claim. But I was the first person who struggled with this. And so I went out and I looked up all my symptoms on the internet. I thought I had hypothyroid. I thought I had adrenal fatigue. I thought I had mental toxicity. So I did all the natural support protocols for these different items based upon my symptoms and never really got anywhere. And so I went through that process that I think many people can probably identify with to eventually figure out at the suggestion of a functional medicine provider that I may have had an intestinal issue. And at first I thought the provider making that recommendation was crazy. I was thinking to myself, I don't have any digestive symptoms, so why are you trying to point us to the gut as a source of those symptoms or my other symptoms? And he ended up being correct. And that was the only line of therapy that really helped me. And so it changed my career trajectory, and it also changed my perspective on how we look at symptoms. And it gave me a much more gut-centric view of the cause of symptoms. And I can say now in my clinical practice, and even with the doctors that I train through our clinician's newsletter, it is amazing at how many patients you will see who have been pursuing, based upon their symptoms, other areas like adrenal fatigue or thyroid or metals, all the while it being actually their gut as a root cause of their symptoms. And that's something I'm really trying to save people from, which is chasing down the symptoms that look like thyroid, that look like adrenal. Not to say that there's not a time and a place for those, but there's many a case where the problems are actually stemming from someone's gut. And if we can get to that root cause, we can finally get to the underpinning of where all those symptoms are coming from. So it's kind of a short synopsis of my
story. Yeah, and I think that's a really important point that you made, particularly around this idea that if there are not gut symptoms, it doesn't mean that the gut isn't playing an enormously important role. And I think that's a good kind of opening to explore a bit more about just kind of why the gut is so important in fatigue, or put another way, why the gut is so important in energy and having optimum health and well-being.
Sure. Well, the gut is so important for a couple of reasons. One, it's really the most impactful immune barrier you have in your entire body. And so we know that 90% of our the majority of our immune cells are contained in the small intestine. So the largest density of immune cells you see anywhere in the entire body is actually located in your small intestine. Now, why is that relevant? Well, arguably, your immune system is the chief source of inflammation in your body, because the immune system uses inflammation as its instrument of cleaning up and attacking things that it doesn't want there. So if you think of your immune cells like little police officers, their guns would be these guns that shoot inflammation at the stuff we don't want, and that's how they attack. So the problem is, if the immune system is overzealous, or there's this chronic battle or leaky permeability issue in the gut, the immune system will constantly be responding with inflammation. And those inflammatory proteins can go systemic and cause problems like joint pain and brain fog and whatever else. So that's one fundamental reason. Also, of course, our calorie and nutrient absorption occurs in the gut. So there's this kind of double negative where if the gut isn't functioning properly, you have this cascade of inflammation, and you also can start malabsorbing the nutrients that you need to rebuild and replenish your body. So this is two of the major reasons why the gut is such a fundamental factor in people's health. And if that's not right, it's very hard for other therapies to work, because that is really the foundation upon which we might want to stack other therapies.
What one of the statistics that really landed for me when I was reading your book is that the small intestine is responsible for 90% of caloric absorption. And I think people often think of the digestive system as being it has a series of steps. I'd never quite realized just how crucial the small intestine is in effectively the first step in energy production.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why that piece about the small intestine is relevant is because many of the gut recommendations circulating on the internet are more focused around large intestine health. And so if you're putting most of your recommendations upon the less important area of your digestion, it's no surprise some people struggle with improving their gut health, because the majority of the recommendations are focused on the smallest part of, or a smaller part of your gut. And how this plays out is some simple dietary recommendations that are supposed to feed bacteria in the gut, just as one example. They look good on paper for the large intestine, but they oftentimes are counterproductive for the small intestine. And this can frustrate people, because they change their diet and they may actually feel worse. They may actually feel more bloated or more fatigued. And it may be because they think they're doing their system a favor by trying to eat to improve their large intestine health, but that recommendation is actually at odds with what the small intestine actually needs.
So maybe to go a bit deeper into this, say a bit more about what triggers inflammation in the guts. Like what's the primary source of inflammation, which then of course has this cascade impact in terms of leaky gut and everything else that then kind of comes from that?
Well, this can get a little bit complicated, but what I try to provide people is a somewhat linear hierarchy of steps to work through, where instead of having this whole litany of potential causes of inflammation and leaving the user up to figure out how to navigate through these, we provide a linear step-by-step process, starting with the most commonly problematic factors. And that's, of course, where you want to start, and ending with the more esoteric or more nuanced factors. And that in and of itself can be a hugely cathartic change for people. Because what I found, and this is one of the sad things about the nature of the internet, is the new and novel stuff is what gets more attention on the internet. Those things rise higher in Google searches, higher in podcast feeds. And so you're more likely as a healthcare consumer to come across the new and nuanced that are really the end of the hierarchy. And that is one reason why so many people flounder. They spend the majority of their time trying to piece together different nuanced therapies while missing the really preliminary frontline therapies that should be situated first. And one of those, of course, is your diet. That's really, your diet and your lifestyle are the two areas that have to be accounted for first. Now, the challenge is that no one diet is going to work well for everyone. There's a few contending diets that someone should trial. And by going through a few week trial period of dietary experimentation, they can find what diet works best for them. But another challenge that the healthcare consumer is confronted with is you get oftentimes these dogmatic views on diet. Everyone should be on low carb, or too much fat. If you go low carb, fat is bad for you. Don't eat fat. Go high carb. Go vegetarian. Go carnivore. And people are just like, oh my God, how do I navigate these? Well, the truth is, for most diets, there's some evidence to support them. So it's not an issue of this is the best diet, but rather here are the few diets that are the most well supported. And here's how we can have you try one, reevaluate after a couple weeks. If you're feeling a lot better, great. That tells you you're on the right track. If you're not feeling a lot better, then change to a different diet. And there's really two, I think, initial diets that people can start with. You have an elimination diet, meaning eliminating common inflammatory foods. And this is oftentimes well depicted by the paleo diet. The paleo diet isn't the only diet to use there, but that's just one kind of in a box diet that will give you an elimination of many inflammatory foods. And that's one. And the other good contender is a lower FODMAP diet. And this is different, where it's more so focused on limiting foods that encourage bacterial growth. And if you're someone who has an excess of bacteria in, let's say, your small intestine, if you're eating a diet that encourages bacterial growth and you already have a lot of bacteria, obviously that can be problematic. So the low FODMAP diet limits foods that feed bacteria and thus can kind of starve these bacteria and help get them into a better balance. So those are really two kind of key diets that people can start with, and it only really requires a couple weeks on a trial of each one of these to at least be able to say, yes, I'm feeling better and I'm going to continue with this, or no, I feel no different or maybe even worse, so I'm going to change my dietary approach completely.
And of course, one of the challenges can be that when people start to make dietary changes by themselves and they start to get kind of fear-mongered by lots of different conflicting ideas, one of the things that I've seen happen, and I remember I had chronic fatigue in the mid to late 90s, and back then it was anti-candida diets was kind of the rage back in those days. That what I noticed was happening to me and happened to others is each week you kind of discover a new food that you should be avoiding. So you end up with less and less kind of foods. So I think what you're saying is really interesting, that it's not just going on diets and following them kind of blindly, endlessly forever, that actually it's tracking symptoms. Like, does this actually have a positive impact in terms of how I'm feeling? And there should be something that's fairly quick, right, in terms of that feedback.
To initially assess if the diet's working for you, yes, usually only 2 to 3 weeks is enough time to tell if the diet's helping. Now, it's not to say that you'll see all of your improvement in 2 to 3 weeks, but you'll at least be able to make that initial benchmark evaluation of yes, it's helping, or no, it's not helping. And you also make another, I think, very important point, which is we don't want to couch these diets in dogmatic, overzealous, fear-mongering terms. A, because most dietary changes don't require 100% adherence to yield a benefit, and B, because that can really lead to unnecessary fear in people, how they are perceiving food. And that in of itself, there have been more patients than I'd like to admit that a huge improvement for them was realized after we let them know, hey, you know, it's okay if you're not perfect. I expect you to make a few errors with your diet or be at a work function or a family event and not be able to fully follow the diet. That's okay. As long as you're compliant most of the time, then you're going to be just fine. And that alleviated a huge burden of stress. And there had, again, been more patients than I'd like to admit who saw very substantial improvements in how they were feeling just by coming to terms with they don't have to staunchly follow the boundaries of a given diet.
You touched on a little bit earlier bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine, or SIBO as it's kind of become commonly known. And it seems to be that over the last few years, there's been a significant kind of increase in understanding and awareness. And I think rightly so, in terms of particularly actually the kind of chronic fatigue population. So maybe could you outline a little bit of what, when we talk about SIBO, what we mean by that? Some of the impacts of that and why that's important to this conversation.
Sure. So SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, is one of many different imbalances that can occur in the bacteria, fungus, and other like life in your gut. And that can lead to this chronic immune activation like we talked about a moment ago, and the ensuing chronic inflammation, and in some cases can also lead to nutrient malabsorption. Now, what's interesting here is this isn't just a theory where we're saying, well, theoretically, this inflammation could make you tired and speculate, which is really important not to do that, because the more we speculate, the more we open the door for potential errors. There is at least one study looking at a low FODMAP diet, which is the diet that kind of starves the bacteria, and has shown an improvement in chronic fatigue. Not to mention the ability of a low FODMAP diet to lead to a litany of improvements in digestive symptoms. And some evidence now is even tacitly supporting that you may see improvements in joint pain or neurological symptoms after following a low FODMAP diet. So there is outcome evidence. We take a group of people and we do this and they see something good happen. That outcome data is available for the low FODMAP diet as it pertains to fatigue. And as that is treating ostensibly the bacterial overgrowth, people are feeling better. And it's, again, likely because there is this existing problem of too much bacteria and or immune activation in the intestines, and that low FODMAP diet actually improves that situation. And this should be contrasted to a paleo diet, which can also be helpful for this group of patients. But for some people, when they go on a paleo-type diet, a diet high in fruits and vegetables and some proteins and healthy fats, they may inadvertently start eating lots of high FODMAP fruits and vegetables. They may actually feel worse. So that little adjustment for some people can be really helpful. And I understand how defeating that could feel, where you're going through all this effort to eat and prepare lots of vegetables, and ironically, you're feeling worse when you do that. And you're not alone. If you notice that, you are certainly not alone in that observation. And this is why I think the low FODMAP diet has risen to popularity, not only in the lay communities, but also in the research community. So that's just one example of how SIBO and your gut health and a dietary intervention can all either contribute to or improve someone's underlying fatigue.
And there's been some pretty compelling data around SIBO. In fact, there's been claims that as much as, I think it's 86% of irritable bowel syndrome could be put down to SIBO. Is your sense that SIBO really is the kind of the depth of villain that is kind of out there, or that it's, you mentioned it's kind of one of a number of factors. So how do you contextualize that in the larger picture of things that could be going on that could be causing digestive issues?
Yeah. And thank you for asking that question. And I do use that phrasing on purpose, one of many, because I do think that SIBO can be, of course, a significant factor, but it, I think, has gotten a little bit ahead of itself in terms of the claims that are starting to propagate on the internet in terms of SIBO being the cause of everything and the culprit for everything. And what ends up happening here is a condition gains in popularity, and then people start blaming everything on that condition, even without any documentation that that condition is actually present. So someone presumes they have SIBO, their symptoms flare, and they say, oh, my SIBO is acting up. And this just catches fire, and eventually you have all these people saying, oh yeah, it was my SIBO flare too, and they don't even know if they actually have SIBO. So, you know, being too vague in our use of some of this terminology allows things to get out ahead of themselves. And so, yes, SIBO is one item, but the claim that SIBO causes all problems, it's not really a tenable claim. there's some controversy regarding the testing. So some SIBO testing may actually report a positive when the person's not actually positive. And in the SIBO research, we're seeing adjustments being made in terms of how you interpret a SIBO breath test to guard against those false positives. Again, a false positive is your test says you have the condition, but you actually don't have the condition. It's an error in the test. And so that's why I'm bridled in how quickly I assign the majority of problems to be caused by this one thing. It's one thing of a few, or I should say several, that could be a problem. And I should also point out, regarding testing, there are things that we know exist that do not have tests that are available for routine clinical practice, like small intestinal fungal overgrowth or hydrogen sulfide SIBO. So it's important not to put all of our eggs in the testing basket. And for example, in my book, Healthy Gut, Healthy You, there have been a litany of not only patients, but even doctors who are applying that book protocol and getting fantastic results. And the book protocol calls for no testing. So if you understand that hierarchy that we outlined or we alluded to a moment ago in terms of start here and then go there, and if you have a well-constructed hierarchy and you work through that in a stepwise fashion, you can see resolution of, I would argue, the majority of gut cases without any testing. And that's important because the testing gets expensive. And so if you're spending a couple of weeks to perform testing and a few hundred or sometimes a couple thousand dollars on testing, that's only giving you one fraction of the possibilities in the gut. You can be given this false promise where you think the testing is going to provide all the answers, but it actually doesn't. And unfortunately, lay people oftentimes don't get that greater overarching context. They get an article on SIBO devoid of the larger overarching context, which is SIBO is one of many a thing, and the SIBO testing is good and getting better, but it's not perfect. So it's very important to find that right balance with using diagnostic solutions to help us, but also not to kind of hinder us by making us have this tunnel vision to only treating the test results at the absence of treating the patient.
Yes. And certainly my observation is that there are a number of people that are getting SIBO diagnosis, they're treating SIBO, and they're having significant improvements. So clearly there's a piece going on here, but it seems, it does feel similar to, and it may not have been so much the case in the US, but certainly here in the UK in the mid to late 90s, Candida was this, just like, it was pretty much, if you have ME chronic fatigue, as it was called here, you have Candida. And then thousands of people went on these anti-Candida diets. And it seems to have that similar kind of somewhat faddish quality to it. It's probably, as you say, is overstated, but also still important. You touched on SIFO, and what are some of the other pieces that, as a clinician, you're looking for when you're kind of diagnosing what's the source of what's going on? And I'd love to come a bit further down the steps of the protocol after diet and how you work with people.
Sure. And you also make an excellent point, which is, yes, Candida was the thing that we thought was causing all the gut problems maybe 10 years ago. And now SIBO is kind of the it thing. And I'm sure in a year it's going to be something else. So what's important, I think, to keep in mind is many of the treatments that have been used, they treat many of these underlying imbalances. So many of these diets will help with Candida or with SIBO or with H. pylori or with leaky gut. Many probiotics will help with Candida or with SIBO or with H. pylori or with Blastocystis hominins. So that's really important to keep in mind, which is the theory that something is wrong in the gut has been correct. The nuance of what exactly it was in the gut has shifted, but the treatments haven't really shifted much. And so that's why, you know, this all kind of pieces together. If you realize we want to treat the gut a bit holistically, and it's not to say that if we use this one probiotic, it's just treating SIBO. It's likely fighting SIBO, H. pylori, and Candida, and just rather pushing your gut back into balance. And so that's why I say we don't need this high definitive testing, because we're likely doing multiple things at the same time when we use a given gut therapy, whether it be diet or probiotics. So we don't want to think in these kind of, you know, reductionistic terms about one factor. But to your question, what would be one of the next steps? After you try those diets, and you know, essentially you want to get the diet that 2 to 3 week benchmark evaluation period. If you feel like it's working, continue until you plateau. Some people will plateau at 90% improvement, and I would argue that you're pretty much there if you're at 90% improvement with a little additional. Let's say you, at 3 weeks, you're noticing you're improving on a low FODMAP diet, and then by 10 weeks, you feel like you've kind of plateaued. and you've plateaued at about 90% improvement. If you're that close to perfect, then in another month or two, and just with some time and as things kind of calm down in your system, you may get the rest of the way there to that 100%. Also realizing that 100%, depending on how you're subjectifying this, may not ever be possible, right? That 100%, yes. What you're saying is 100% may be this, you know, utopian-like idea of health. But after that, then one of the next things that you can do is use a well-rounded probiotic protocol. And unfortunately, you know, and I don't mean to sound like a naysayer, but much of what you see on the internet regarding probiotics, it's about this is the special strain, this is the best probiotic. And, you know, unfortunately what happens is every time there's a new study showing a new finding with a probiotic, that company shouts from the rooftop, here's the best probiotic that's meant for this and for that. And what I've noticed over the years as I've watched the body of probiotic literature evolve is you can see many different types of probiotics all achieve the same improvement. Now, one formula will be the first formula documented to lead to that improvement. But then in another 6 months, another formula shows the same improvement. And in another 6 months, a different formula shows the same improvement. So I don't look at probiotics like drugs. This probiotic is a probiotic for UTIs. This probiotic is a probiotic for depression and anxiety. That's an erroneous way of looking at this, because probiotics, they're not like cholesterol lowering medications that do one thing in the body and lower or block an enzyme, as cholesterol medications do. These are helping to restore your gut ecology and kind of support a system, and that system, the gut, can manifest as a litany of symptoms. So when you support the gut, it could manifest for different people in different ways. If you're someone like me whose gut connects more so to neurological issues, any probiotic that improved my gut health would theoretically improve my brain fog. So it's not about the one probiotic that has a study showing it's the best for brain fog. And this is what I think really harms people, is they go from product to product to product, not understanding this larger overarching philosophy that most probiotics can be classified into one of three categories. And this is, I write about this in Healthy Gut, Healthy You. You have your category one, which are predominantly lactobacillus and bifidobacterium strain blends. Category two is Saccharomyces boulardii, a healthy fungus. And category three is a mixture of different bacillus or soil-based or spore-forming strains. And we've released one formula in each of these categories. And what's key for people to do is to experiment to find what one or combination of these three probiotics help them. Some people may be saying, well, I've negatively reacted to a probiotic. You'd be shocked how many people have tried three different types of, let's say, those spore-forming or soil-based probiotics. So those are kind of popular right now. And so people will come into the office and will go through their treatment history, and they say, yeah, I've negatively responded to probiotics. They probe a little further. They tried one form of a category three, another form of a category three, and another form of a category three. And they're shocked as to why they never responded well to probiotics, because they keep trying the same iteration of a formula or different iterations of the same formula. So what we recommend people do, if you're sensitive, you start with one formula at a time, give yourself about a week, and then reevaluate. If you're feeling worse, then that means that particular category may not work well for your unique gut biome. But if it's helping, continue, and then add in a category two and trial that one. And then if that goes well, continue. If it does go well, stop. And then go to category three and continue with what works for your gut, and don't use any that don't work for your gut. And this is how you personalize the three categories to your gut. Now, if you're someone who hasn't been sensitive historically, you could start with all three at once. And all you're doing there is you're trying to minimize variables. So if someone's really sensitive, higher probability they're going to have a negative reaction. So you want to go slow, one formula at a time. So if you do have a negative reaction, it's easy to see where it's coming from. Discontinue that probiotic and continue forward.
And are you a fan of cycling different probiotics at different times, or do you see it work well to find what works and just keep taking that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this is another area where we make things far more complicated than they really have to be. What I think is very important clinically is to understand that probiotics for some people may have this saturation point where they work for a term and then people actually see their symptoms regress if they keep taking them. And this is because most probiotics, not all, but most probiotics don't actually colonize you, but rather they have a transient effect. And so they kind of build up in your system as they're transitioning through. And I think what happens is as you're continuing to take probiotics on a daily basis, you're having more buildup in your system. They're doing all the good things that they do, like fight infection, fight dysbiosis, improve leaky gut. And after a while, though, if too much builds up in that transient state, then you can have this oversaturation of your system with probiotics. And now you're starting to see a negative return on the therapy. And so I recommend, like I do with most things, people achieve their peak level of improvement, give themselves maybe another 4 weeks after that to make sure that they're stable in that improvement, and then work to find the minimal effective dose. And for some people, that minimal effective dose is nothing. They come off the probiotics and they maintain all of their improvements. For other people, they notice their stools are a little bit looser, or they're a little bit more constipated, or they're a little bit more foggy. So they go back on a small dose and find the minimal effective dose. And that's a very important concept, because applying it as such can really lead to improvements in how you're feeling and get you out of this whole, well, you have to do this and then reseed and take these with food and take those without food and take these and then take, and that's just, it's so littered with speculation, and it takes people from away from this more simple protocol that we just laid out that can really lead to nice results.
So you're starting off by focusing on diet and trying the different kind of pieces there. And then you're bringing in the probiotic piece. What's the next piece in the, if that's then not enough in terms of progress, where do you tend to look next?
Sure. And I should mention, just for your users, if they want a real simple list overview, we created a one-page PDF that gives you the sensitive patient probiotic protocol or the non-sensitive patient probiotic protocol. If they go to our website, drrusco.com, drrusco.com/probiotics, they can download that one-page PDF and it'll walk them right through it. And it's as easy as I can make it for you there in one PDF with everything kind of laid out for you. But your question in terms of what do you do next? Well, then the next best thing to do for most people is to consider a course of antimicrobial therapy. And these are things like your oregano, your garlics, your allicin, your berberines, your neems, your caprylic acids. And these are a bit more powerful in helping to clean out any overgrowths or unwanted players. And I should mention that probiotics are quite effective in treating things like SIBO or H. pylori or fungus. People don't often appreciate that, but probiotics are actually pretty effective in cleaning out these unwanted players or helping to reestablish better balance in the colonization in the gut. But for some people, that's not enough in and of itself. And so what can thwart some people is they try diet, they're not cured by the diet, and so they give up on diet. And then they go to probiotics, they're not cured by probiotics, they give up on probiotics. And they don't realize if they could just look at these things as a succession of small steps forward. Well, okay, the diet didn't cure you, but do you feel at least 25% better? Yes. All right, continue the diet, now add in the probiotics. Okay, and the probiotics now got you to 60% total improvement. Great, we're moving in the right direction. Continue with that, and let's layer on top of this another input to the gut, which would be these antimicrobials. And for many people, that gets them over this final hump of finally getting to a high level of improvement, 80, 90, 100%. But it's understanding that you're not looking for all your improvement from one thing, but rather understanding how to sequence these things. And then this is a contention I make in the book, which is the difference between knowledge and wisdom is experience. People can get knowledge of all these different treatments on the internet, but they have no clue how to use them. And that's why people flounder with and don't see the results from these compounds they have access to. And I make the analogy also in the book that if your car broke down and we let you into the mechanics machine shop, just because you had access to all his tools wouldn't mean you have any clue how to use them. Same thing happens with these natural medicines. You have access to them, yes, but it doesn't mean that you know how to use them. And that's one of the big things that I think it's really important to highlight with the book protocol. It's not that there is this new, crazy, novel, you know, sexy treatment. It's understanding how to take the well-studied treatments available for your gut and apply them in the appropriate sequence to fix your gut ecology.
And whereabouts in the sequence would you bring in things like hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes? Is that something you would come to as a final step or something that you might introduce earlier in that sequence?
Yep, great question. So enzymes and hydrochloric acid are part of step two. So they're on par with probiotics, but there are some caveats and some nuances regarding hydrochloric acid. Not everyone needs hydrochloric acid. And there are some history factors and presentation factors you can look at to determine, are you more likely to need HCl, hydrochloric acid, or less likely? Now, the older you are, all these factors increase your need for HCl. The older you are, being over 65 especially, if you have a history of an autoimmune condition, or if you have a history of anemia, all of those increase up to maybe 50% that you'll need hydrochloric acid. Now, if you're younger, there's no history of autoimmunity, you have no history of anemia, and especially if you're young and you have things like reflux and heartburn, it's highly likely, it's not a guarantee, but it's highly likely that HCl will be a bad idea for you. Now, this gets confusing, but if you're older and you have reflux, you may see the reflux go away when using HCl. So it's a little bit confusing because sometimes the same treatment can either make the same symptom better or worse, but we lay out some of those nuances in the book protocol. That is one of the hairier aspects to navigate, but it is important to maybe counteract the natural medicine belief that everyone needs hydrochloric acid all the time. I think that's not really a tenable case. The enzymes, you're a little bit less at risk for any negative impact from enzymes. So we do offer people kind of a low dose enzyme HCl combination formula with a couple caveats of, if you're in this group, be careful. If you're in this group, more likely to help you. Here's the warning signs to look out for. If you experience any warning sign, stop.
Fascinating. I think these nuances and these details are often the difference that makes the difference, right?
Yep.
I'd like to change tack slightly and explore a little bit around the relationship between gut health and hormones. So maybe you could say a little bit around how improving gut health will impact upon things like adrenal function, the relationship with the thyroid.
Well, the thyroid piece is I think a crucially important one. And I'm sure you've talked about thyroid, of course, when fatigue comes up, thyroid probably one of the quickest things to jump in terms of a potential. And yes, undiagnosed hypothyroidism can of course be a cause of fatigue. But the thinking that there's this whole mass of people who their conventional doctor has missed the hypothyroid diagnosis, that is incorrect. And it's getting so bad now that there are even independent researchers, for example, there was a study published in Greece earlier this year that looked at people with kind of this ambiguous hypothyroid diagnosis. They found, and this is I believe it was in 199 patients, so a decent sample size. They found that 60% of the people in that group were not actually hypothyroid. Now, it's not just in Greece that they're finding this. I'm finding this in my practice quite commonly, alarmingly commonly. And even the clinicians who read our newsletter and are applying some of these concepts are now finding this in their clinics. In fact, we just published in our clinicians' newsletter a guest case study from Dr. Robert Abbott, who's finding this same thing in his practice, and he's getting admittedly irritated that people are being misdiagnosed with hypothyroid, being put on thyroid medication, not seeing an optimal response, all because the provider is either educated poorly, meaning they've been given some overzealous education, or they're not being objective enough and just kind of expecting everything to be caused by a problem with the thyroid. But at the end of the day, what ends up happening is these people are told they're hypothyroid when they're not, and they're given medication and it doesn't make them feel much better, and they end up staying on the medication for years. I mean, I've seen patients who've been on medication for 5 years, and we look at the labs diagnosing their hypothyroidism, and they are clearly not hypothyroid, not even by any generous stretch of the diagnostic criteria, and it's no wonder they're not feeling any better. Now, there are people who are truly hypothyroid, yes, of course, but what we want to be careful to do is not jump to hypothyroidism as a cause of the fatigue if there's not clear diagnostic lab evidence justifying that, and at the expense of, here's a person with gut symptoms that haven't been addressed, as exactly was the case in this case study and many a case study where the hypothyroid diagnosis was loosely thrown out there. Someone was put on thyroid medication, didn't see an optimal response, a problem in the gut was missed, and that was left unfettered for years and years and years, only to make their way to a guy like myself or one of the clinicians from our newsletter. And they look at the lab work and they say, you are never hypothyroid. Did you feel any better on the medication? Not really. Okay, let's go to work on your gut. A few months later, all their symptoms are gone. Again, I don't want to disparage any provider who's treating thyroid. Obviously, that can be a very important thing, but it's being blamed for far more than it's actually causing. And this is leading to an endemic problem of overdiagnosis of hypothyroidism in the functional medicine community.
And I guess part of what's also happening there is that the thyroid medication can give people a bit more energy, right? And so if their gut function's not working and their fatigue's as a result of that, in a sense, the thyroid medication is compensating for the symptom of fatigue, but it's not really dealing with the underlying cause.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can make an argument. I don't think it's a highly tenable argument, but I think you can make an argument of using thyroid hormone support in the short term to help someone who's dealing with this inflammatory burden from their gut. I'm okay with that, but here's the problem. These doctors are not telling the patients, you don't have hypothyroidism, but we could give you some thyroid support to get your levels a little bit more optimal and then get you off of it. These people are walking around thinking they have a diagnosed disease when they actually don't. And that distinguishment between hypothyroidism disease, thyroid support for just some optimization, that delineation isn't being made. Now, it's also important to mention that there's a fair body of evidence showing that patients can feel worse, especially if they're given a combination T4 plus T3 medication when they don't need support. And this is because part of what you see, it's known as euthyroid 6 syndrome. When people are inflamed, they can have, especially when they're in a critical illness situation, so very ill, they'll see a decrease of T3 that's a metabolic adaptation to reduce the stress on their body. And so finding someone who's not truly hypothyroid, but their downstream hormones are skewing, and which the body's doing on purpose to try to protect the body from the stress that is the rev up cellularly from thyroid hormone. And then you say, well, that's low, so we're just going to give them a bunch of that and try to force the body to do what we want. Some patients will actually feel more fatigued or be anxious or have anxiety. And there are a number of patients, and this was hard for me to figure out at first, when patients would come in on something like Armour Thyroid or Nature Thyroid, these T4, T3 combinations, which are supposed to be so much better purportedly, and claiming that they actually felt worse when they went on them. And it wasn't until I stepped back and look at the literature that you see things like meta-analyses showing that only a minority of patients, but yes, some patients will do better on these combination formulas, but you run the risk when you give those combination formulas preemptively, when you haven't built a case for them, that someone may actually feel worse. So there's a lot of nuance here that it's hard to get into all of it. But the one thing I'd want the viewer to come away with is make sure the person who's diagnosed you with hypothyroidism seems to be objective. And you may want to probe into, am I truly hypothyroid, or do I just have some non-optimal values? And if you're being given thyroid hormone and not feeling any better, there's a good chance that the problem may actually be coming from your gut.
Fascinating. That's a really, really interesting piece. And I'm mindful of time, but I'd also just love to touch on a little bit around patients that you work with, which because their gut has been so inflamed and so irritated for so long, that then become very sensitive to a lot of the treatments they might otherwise do. For example, people that need antimicrobials that can't tolerate antimicrobials because pretty much anything they take, they have a reaction to. What are some of your preferred ways of navigating those sensitivities?
Great question. So for some of these patients they're very sensitive, there's kind of two strategies we can employ. One would be going through those same therapies, but doing it very cautiously and one treatment at a time in a stepwise fashion. So instead of all three probiotics, one at a time. Instead of two different antimicrobials, one at a time. So sometimes the way to get there is just to slow down a little bit, do one thing at a time, and whenever you see a reaction, try a different formula. And I also actually talk about this in the book, which is, it's oftentimes preferable when using, as an example, antimicrobials, to use a cocktail of maybe 7 to 10 different antimicrobials in one capsule. For someone who's highly reactive, though, we may be better served by using a single ingredient antimicrobial. And so I offer an alternate protocol for highly sensitive patients where if you notice historically that you're very reactive, then let's not use the 10 ingredient formula. Let's use a one ingredient formula. And if you tolerate that, great, we'll continue with it. If not, we'll try another single ingredient formula. Obviously, because if you have more ingredients and you're reactive, it's a higher probability that something in there will irritate your system. So that's one approach, is just simplifying the landscape a bit. Another approach can be using other gut supports. And there's a few contenders here. An elemental diet is essentially a gut-friendly, I'll kind of give them to you quick and then we can go through them in more detail if you want. That's a really hypoallergenic liquid meal replacement that someone can do this exclusive liquid nutrition for a few days or even longer as kind of a gut reset. There's also certain nutrients that can help to rebuild the gut lining. And then there's also immunoglobulins, which can help to bind toxins and irritants in the gut. And the formulas I use there are elemental heal, gut rebuild nutrients, and intestinal repair formula. It's not that you have to use all of these at once, but they all support the gut to help kind of calm down this overzealous inflammatory reactive immune system. And so those are all viable options that can help these sensitive patients get their gut a little bit more able to tolerate these things that can further kind of heal or further combat this bacterial and fungal or other imbalances that might be present.
That's fascinating. And actually it makes sense. Sometimes you have to calm things down enough to then be able to do the other pieces. Before we come to how people can find out more about you and your work, just one thing I know that also is important to you, and I think it's been somewhat implicit in what you've been saying, which is that gut healthcare doesn't necessarily have to cost the earth. And I think a lot of people which have been down either the self-treatment path or they've been seeing a lot of different practitioners, they can spend a small fortune on tests and supplements. So right. how do you encourage people to be able to do this in such a way that it doesn't end up necessarily having to result in remortgaging the house to pay for the process?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the runaway cost of functional medicine is also a serious issue that I think needs to be reformed. And there's definitely a growing faction of the functional medicine movement that are trying to make this reform. And I think this is a growing pain in the field, which is a good growing pain, which means we thought we needed a lot of stuff to get people healthy. Now, with the gift of having increased scientific scrutiny of what we're doing, we're realizing that of all these things that we were doing, offering a patient, a couple of them may have really been responsible for the majority of the benefit the patient was receiving. So we can consolidate to those things and cut the fat out of the model. Some people are fighting that. Other people are embracing that. But I guess that's just what happens with the tides of change. That distinction in philosophy can be the difference between a couple $100 of treatment or a few $1,000 worth of treatment. And this is legitimate. And the same thing applies with testing, which is why in the book, I don't call for any testing, because you can see most patients fully improve without needing any testing. Is there a time and a place? Yes. But there's no way I could scientifically defend the statement that to use these diets, to use these probiotics, to use these antimicrobials, to use these immunoglobulins or elemental diets that we've been talking about, you must have testing pre-post to do that. That is not a scientifically defensible statement to make, and therefore it's not something that I endorse. Now, can you use those tests to help guide some of these treatments? Yes, but you would really be surprised how far you can get if you administer one therapy, listen to the person's symptomatic response, and use that to inform what your next step should be. And yes, that will bring down the cost of care. I mean you can go through, depending on how stubborn someone's case is, you could go through the entire protocol in the book for the cost of 1 to 2 functional medicine tests. So by the time you were just getting started, you could be done from a financial perspective. And that is important to mention. And again, it's not to say that testing is bad, but it is, in my opinion, vastly overused and to the financial detriment of the patient. Also, I should mention that if these tests are not interpreted appropriately, you can have people thinking that they have a condition that they don't have. And we already hinted at that with thyroid. The same thing happens in the gut. Some of the gut tests are very, very cutting edge and more so experimental. And so even though the test says positive, we don't really know how often that positive is actually positive as compared to just noise. And that's also incredibly important to keep in mind, because some patients, when their labs are being interpreted by an overzealous provider, they walk away thinking they have 10 things wrong with them, when they really may have nothing wrong with them at all. It's just some of these markers are experimental. There's one example really quick here, zonulin, a marker for leaky gut. The evidence showing that zonulin is highly correlated to conditions, it's not fully bore out. Yes, there is some evidence documenting that people with certain diseases will have higher zonulin, but there's also evidence showing that when people go on certain diets and feel vastly better, their zonulin tests get worse. So, I mean, these things have to be accounted for with how we interpret these tests, which is one of the reasons why I wouldn't necessarily recommend repeat zonulin testing. You could make a case for it and use it cautiously, but again, we have to be careful, because how do we account for these couple studies showing these people improve their diet, feel way better, yet their zonulin tests got worse? So because of that, I'm cautious with testing. Testing helps bring down the cost, and you're absolutely right. Cost is a problem and something that we want to be sensitive to.
And I think one of the points that I think you make extremely well is also the importance of getting fundamentals in place and taking things in the right sequence. And I think it's absolutely right that it's very easy to get seduced by the shiny object of this kind of new magical thing without recognizing those fundamentals have to be there. Dr. Russo, right. I'm mindful of time. For people to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, there's a couple of resources available to you. You can go to our website, which is drrusciocom, drrusciocom. There's also the book, Healthy Gut, Healthy You, which really gives you the full panacea of information and then closes with that stepwise protocol that you can go through to heal your gut in a personalized fashion. If you're looking for a bit of a quicker on-ramp, then we have developed a quiz at drrusciocom/gutquiz. And this quiz will help give you a personalized, kind of simplified on-ramp protocol to help you start with, based upon your quiz answers, what might be the couple most impactful changes you can make to get started. So those are a few options for you there, depending on, you know, if you're highly motivated or, you know, if you're kind of overwhelmed and looking for just kind of the easy on-ramp. And I mean, there's way more out there on the internet regarding what I'm doing. If you're a clinician, there's our clinician's newsletter where if you go to drrusciocom/review, you can plug in and start learning some information about that. And I would really encourage clinicians to plug in, because I like to think that the group in this newsletter, it's actually really validating to see other doctors now seeing these misdiagnoses, these overutilizations of tests, and making changes with their patients and getting patients healthy who otherwise weren't able to get healthy. So it's not just me able to do it. If, you know, if I document it and share it with other people, they can replicate it and see the same positive experiences for patients, which again has been really, really gratifying to see. So, you know, that's a few things that people can plug into.
That's awesome. Dr. Russo, thank you so much again for your time. And once again, congratulations on an excellent piece of work. I highly recommend people get the book. As I say, I think it's one of the best I've read in a lot of reading over the last few months.
And I appreciate that.
Thanks again for a fantastic interview. It's been really insightful. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.